Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the World Anti-Extremism Network's podcast. I'm your host, Ahrar Ramispur, and thank you for tuning in. Today, we are exploring a crucial topic: how authoritarian regimes are utilizing modern technology to redefine the relationship between power and freedom. As you know, authoritarianism is defined by strong centralized control, limited political pluralism, and the suppression of dissent, often through tight restrictions on individual freedoms. Totalitarianism goes even further, with the state seeking to control every aspect of public and private life. In this digital age, technology has become a double-edged sword. While it can empower citizens, it is also being weaponized by authoritarian regimes to monitor, censor, and manipulate populations, raising urgent questions about rights, resistance, and responsibility. In this episode, we will explore how regimes utilize technology to govern, how people resist, and what the latest technological development mean for both sides. I'm honored to be joined today by Mr. Kyle Matthews as we continue our series of conversations on extremism, governance, and digital power. My guest, Mr. Kyle Matthews, is the co-founder and executive director of the Montreal Institute for Global Security. He previously worked as executive director of the Montreal Institute for Genocide and Human Rights Studies. His work focuses on human rights, international security, emerging technologies, and countering authoritarianism. He is a member of the Global Diplomacy Lab in the BMW Foundation's Global Responsible Leaders Network. He is currently a member of the Government of Canada's Cross-Cultural Roundtable on Security. Welcome, Mr. Kyle, to the WANS podcast. Without further delay, I would like to start my question by asking that, how do you see authoritarian regimes using modern technology to tighten control over the societies? Please, Mr. Mike.
We are seeing countries develop new technologies or take technologies that are developed in the West and using them to control populations, not just in their own territory, but internationally as well. First and foremost, probably if there was a gold medal award to go to any country for this, it would go to China. China's been extremely active in targeting members of the Uyghur community, the Tibetan community, people supporting the Hong Kong's freedom. And they've gone so far as to meddle in Canadian elections and using emerging technologies to spread false information narratives. So this is a big, big problem. And we've seen the rise of a new term called digital authoritarianism. So that term, digital authoritarianism, explains all the different activities that how emerging technologies, AI, social media, digital platforms are being used and weaponized to control society and control criticism or any political opposition, or targeting journalists as well. So this is a real problem. I'm very glad to be on this podcast to talk about it in more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Kyle. You have used a very interesting term, digital authoritarianism. Really, it is a very interesting topic. It's a very important topic also, particularly for the young generation who are trying to tackle against these authoritarian and totalitarian regimes in different parts of the world. China was a very important example you have mentioned. Similarly, we have the Iranian regime, Islamic Republic of Iran. We have the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Recently, they started this kind of restriction on their citizens in terms of using internet in different apps. In other societies, maybe also you have many examples probably. There is a question that, if you please a little bit elaborate about the strategies in also thinking behind tools like surveillance, data collection, and digital censorship in these authoritarian regimes. If you give us some examples. Thanks.
Yeah, so one example I've done for my work is the use of AI and surveillance technology. So surveillance cameras that are proliferating, they're being exported around the world. China is the forefront of the production of this, including from Hikvision and other companies. They've used that to surveil political opposition, the Uyghurs in China and others. But they've also been exporting it to other countries as well. They've been helping Russia's surveillance systems. They've been helping Iran. They've been exporting some of this to Afghanistan. So this is an issue that one has to be careful about, how any of these surveillance systems are deployed, even for commercial purposes, that they might be hacked or be controlled to monitor people. And then that's just the surveillance part. There's a whole aspect of disinformation, right? We've had talks about how some AI platforms, or the Chinese equivalent of ChatGPT, there's a story when it came out a little while ago that people are asking questions about the Tiananmen massacre, and the AI refused to admit that anything happened. So we're seeing that authoritarian regimes can use these AI tools to basically deny reality, to pretend something didn't happen. Historically, it never happened. China might be the leader, but I have no doubt that countries like Iran will do the same, or are trying to do the same. And I should also say is that despite authoritarian states, we're all seeing cases where technologies in democracies are being sold on the open market and being used by other states to monitor journalists, to surveil journalists, political opposition. We had the United Arab Emirates that have bought Pegasus software, but also technology from Canada to do so, to look, to target people. We have, Israeli tech firms also being misused or bought by other democracies. So the threat does come from authoritarian governments, but it's a slippery slope where even in democracies, if we're not careful, these technologies can be misused, even in the name of national security or for whatever reason, or a national emergency, they can be deployed. So we have to be very careful. We have to investigate, research, and raise alarm bells, because we're at a period in history where democracies are backsliding, and we see more and more countries moving towards an authoritarian or autocratic path.
Thank you, Mr. Kualia. You touched upon very critical issues. Denial of realities or historical realities by authoritarian regimes. This is very dangerous, really, as you mentioned, the Tiananmen incident or the Tiananmen movement, how the Chinese government trying to ignore or to do not admit that event through using this AI tool. Interesting, really. If you say something about how does access to the internet differ between democratic and authoritarian regimes, because we're always talking on the rule of law, international legislations or international law on cyber crimes and also internet. Nowadays, this new phenomenon of AI, there is different approach to using internet in democratic systems and also authoritarian regimes. How do you manage this? How is the differences you see?
That's a great question, because we're seeing right now a kind of a splintering of the internet. So if you live in Kenya, if you live in Brazil, Canada, France, you can log on and have access to pretty much every, any Google or any web search engine or any app or any social media company. You have free access to that. But there are countries around the world where it's highly controlled. So I hate to bring this back to China, but China has something called the Great Firewall, where it doesn't allow, Western news organizations like BBC, the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, or the New York Times. It doesn't allow those news agencies or their citizens to access them. They also have, they're limited, and they block access to Facebook, to Twitter, to other aspects. So there's China, which is 20% of the world's humanity, limits access, and that's in order to control information, to control what its citizens know, and to control any dangerous ideas from infiltrating society or what the government deems as dangerous. Of course, unfortunately, we have human rights laws, international human rights law that says, freedom of information, freedom to access information is a key, and that's being blocked in this case. We're also seeing, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, limitations on access to other social media platforms in the U.S. We've just had in Iran with the Iran-Israel war, we've had the Iranian government, you know, shut down the entire internet. Like, there's an internet blackout right now. So we see this increasingly in some authoritarian states or countries that are in conflict, that they're shutting down the internet or certain social media platforms to prevent information from getting out, in order to prevent the world to know what's happening. And it's also done to prevent its citizens or journalists from communicating with the outside world. So this is a dangerous development. And another aspect that I would also argue is we're beginning to see critical internet infrastructure. So we've begun to see authoritarian states also develop military capabilities to cut off internet access. So we've had in the Baltic states, in the Baltic Sea, we've had, we believe, Chinese and Russian attempts to cut undersea internet cables. We're seeing the same thing happen that's affecting Taiwan. So we're seeing that the authoritarian impulse to go even further and to not just control access, but to actually take out the communication infrastructure of other countries and regions. So it's very, very dangerous. I think we're seeing more and more of this, and authoritarian states are collaborating and sharing the playbook much more frequently and at increasing speed. And I have the sense that human rights groups, civil society organizations, and democracies themselves are not working as fast together. So we have to do more work. There's been something set up called the Freedom Online Coalition that has 43 countries that are part of this. It's an important avenue that we can fight back and build coordination to stop this process. But it's a big challenge right now. And we also, I would just frame one last case. There's also, we're seeing countries almost put spies or put pressure on people working for social media companies, including in the U.S., to spy on democracy activists and human rights activists. There was a case where we found out that Saudi Arabia, you know, had people inside Twitter spying on democracy activists, sharing their private messages or trying to locate them, geolocate them, so they could be targeted by repressive tactics. So there's a full-scale war of authoritarian states using Western tech and Western platforms, and we have to wake up and realize that this has an impact on our human rights and our democracy.
Thank you, Kyle. Do you think global tech companies are enabling authoritarian practices, whether internationally or simply by complying with local laws?
I think so. There's been enormous pressure by authoritarian states on tech companies. You know, we just had in Saudi Arabia, we had a Saudi dissident, I believe he was a journalist, who was just sentenced to death last week for tweets he made a couple of years ago. We have increasing countries like Turkey that's putting enormous pressure on social media companies to have a representative in their country, and they want a representative there so that they can take them captive or imprison them to put pressure on companies to go after their political critics or their political opposition. So there's something happening. But at the same time, we've seen, I would argue, the big tech platforms, you know, be it Meta, Facebook, Twitter, we've seen them begin to scale back the monitoring of online threats. We've seen their human rights teams be disbanded under the argument by the Trump administration that anything to deal with disinformation or targeted attacks or election interference is solely aimed at targeting the Republicans. So they've joined hand in hands with the tech platforms and removed any safeguards, any content moderation, any live human rights teams that would monitor this. Facebook's, you know, dangerous threats team is pretty much being disbanded. So it's almost the Wild West right now. And I just point this out. I think, you know, a conservative-leaning newspaper in the U.S., the New York Post, had an article out yesterday showing that Russia has created an entire AI chatbot army to spread disinformation, to create narratives, to separate the MAGA movement, which is Trump supporters. So we're seeing democracy being targeted, and there are live examples of this. And I think some people want to argue it's not that serious. I would argue that it's extremely serious. We're starting to see groups of people, you know, take sides, believing that Russia is not responsible for invading Ukraine. We're seeing people spread misinformation on democracy, misinformation on extremism, misinformation on even public health and vaccines. So I would argue that this is a major problem and we need to put more resources to try to counter it.
Yeah, you're right. This is the right time that there should be some sort of coalitions, as you mentioned before earlier, Freedom Online Coalition, like these platforms, to do something and to encourage the democratic regimes in the West to do something against misusing of digital and AI for suppressing democratic movements and freedom. I think democracy and freedom being targeted by authoritarian regimes and also by radical and extremist groups. This is another aspect of misusing the digital world against freedom. What do you think about these groups like Daesh, like other extremist groups who are using for their campaign the digital platforms?
Yeah. So I began my work on online hate and online disinformation, particularly related to how Daesh, an extremist group that took over parts of Iraq and Syria and have committed large-scale human rights abuses against ethnic religious minorities, against secular Muslims. So I've been following them for a while, and they're extremely dangerous. They're using online platforms to spread disinformation. They're using online platforms to mobilize and inculcate others with their dangerous ideology. They've also been used it to incite violence and to try to sometimes create civil war or get groups to attack each other. So I definitely think that they're a problem. We can't take our eye off the ball from extremist groups. We tend now to think that authoritarian states, which are because they control armies and military budgets and have a seat at the UN, that they are a danger. But by no means should we not consider some of these extremist groups as a danger to democracy, to human rights, and to diaspora groups. And I would maybe just point out is that, so Canada just hosted the G7 summit, and the G7 summit came out with a very strong statement about transnational repression, where they said that increasingly authoritarian states, and including proxy groups, criminal groups, or extremist groups, are targeting activists in democracies, members of diaspora groups for speaking out about wanting democracy in their homelands, for speaking out about human rights abuses in their homelands. And they specifically mentioned that the G7 needs to work to deal with digital transnational repression. And in Canada, we've seen Iranian diaspora groups targeted online. That's led to offline violence. We've had a former Canadian Minister of Justice, Erwin Kotler, who's being targeted by Iran and threatened by death by criminal networks. But a lot of this started online with disinformation. We have, members of the Ukrainian community being targeted. We have people from the Afghan community that are being targeted. We have a lot of different groups, as well as elected officials and journalists. So the G7 stated we need to take this seriously, particularly of how authoritarian actors, government and non-government, are using tech to hinder and limit the movement or freedom of expression of individuals and journalists. We need to take this seriously. But that's an opening that I think we might see more coordination and funding go to think tanks and organizations that want to help fight this phenomenon.
Yeah. What do you think about the role of civil society, academics, research institutions, and think tanks?
Listen, I think we have an important role to play because first and foremost, governments move very slowly. Governments can coordinate stuff at the UN, can work with partners, can share intelligence, can provide funding to civil society groups to do more. But the reality is that it's really think tanks and academic institutions that can do research to understand what is happening. Of course, we also, as civil society, can mount advocacy campaigns to demand action or to put a spotlight on what authoritarian states are doing and can share that with the media and to inform the wider public. Sometimes governments are afraid to do so for hurting their diplomatic relations or would rather say things behind closed doors. So all those organizations have an important role to say. But I also say that those civil society groups, all of them, also have a role to interact with tech companies and tell the tech companies, you must change what you're doing. You must track this, or there's a weakness in your system. or tell them if they're encountering inauthentic bots that are targeting individuals across the world. So yeah, they have an important role, and very often the important work is being done by them. Small civil society groups can move faster than governments can in many ways, and can work for less money and be more efficient.
Yeah. You have mentioned a very important point. Direct interaction with these AI companies or digital companies or platforms like Twitter or Facebook and others by civil society will play a very critical role to improve the situation. It's very important because some of our audiences in the past communicated with us in saying that, unfortunately, these platforms like Twitter and others, they are not listening. They are not caring to the complaints of people whenever they are reporting some violence in these portals. For instance, we have seen a number of threats by or propaganda by these radical Islamist groups. But unfortunately, whenever these people saying we are reported to these platforms, they didn't act properly. They just ignored or they just replied saying this is not contradicting with our policies. And just what do you think about this kind of policies? Do you think that civil society's approach and government's approach finally will create some proper space or proper situation for in this context?
I think we've had mixed success. You know, we've had mixed success. We've had, after Daesh or some of these extremist groups have committed terrorist attacks or atrocity attacks, there have been lawsuits against Twitter, lawsuits against Facebook. That's changed their behavior a little bit, but not enough. And I do think for these extremist groups, there are actors in society that have tried or have worked very effectively to have any criticism of these religious extremists. If I criticize them, we'll turn around and say, you're being racist, that I'm the problematic person, not those that are inciting violence against others. So I think we have a battle together that we need to work with diaspora groups, religious groups, and come together and share. We have common humanitarian concerns against these extremists. They don't represent the mainstream Muslim communities across the planet, and that we must work together to silence them and to take them offline. There have been, unfortunately, bad actors that have, I think, convinced others that these groups are not extremist or they're not really dangerous, and others fighting against them are the problem. And I've seen that. I've been attacked for calling out these extremists for what they've done in Afghanistan or globally, or if they've targeted Salman Rushdie or their authors. I think the time has come for us to really work more closely together and silence those that are manipulating narratives that are simply falsehoods and need to be pushed back upon.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kyle Matthews, for joining us in today's podcast. We hope to have you again in our next programs to discuss further about these kind of issues and topics in WENS podcast.
Thank you for having me on. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.